Call this meeting to the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 8:03 a.m. on Tuesday, March 22nd, 2022. I want to thank our House Records Secretary, Lori Rowland, and our LIO moderator, Lydia Klein, for helping us with all the behind-the-scenes work here today. As we start, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. And present today, we have Representative Drummond, Representative Puckettuck, Co-Chair Hannon, and myself, Co-Chair Shragi. Today, the committee will be beginning a presentation from the Department of Corrections. Committee members should feel free to ask questions during the presentation at the end of each slide. If there is any follow-up, we can address it on Thursday when the department is back before us. With that, I would like to invite Kelly Good, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections, up to the table first. Deputy Commissioner, we've already got you at the table. Thank you. Let's see, I know you have quite a few members from your team with you, which is wonderful to see. Please feel free to call them up as you see fit. With that, if you could please put yourself on the record and begin with your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, Kelly Good, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Corrections. Thanks for inviting us. The presentation before you today is actually addressing direct requests from the two co-chairs, and so it doesn't flow quite as smooth as we normally would because we're hitting areas that you guys have an interest in. So today to start, and I do have a team here, and we can call on them and use them as we need through the presentation to address particular topics as they come up. But for the first presentation, I'd like to ask Director Winkleman to come to the table. Director Jen Winkleman is our Director of Pretrial, Probation, and Parole. And this will address the question posed by the committee about electronic monitoring utilization. And we just have a few slides on this one, and I'll let Director Winkleman take it from here.
Thank you. Very good. And let the record reflect that Representative McCarty joined us at 8:04 a.m. Good morning.
Morning.
Great. Good morning. For the record, my name is Jen Winkleman. I am the director of the Division of Pretrial, Probation, and Parole. As you'll often hear, we fondly refer to ourselves as DP3. Deputy Commissioner Good mentioned, one of the questions posed was with regard to utilization of electronic monitoring. And so I handle the pretrial end of electronic monitoring. And the first slide, essentially what it talks about is that under the criminal justice reform of 2016, the initiative, it launched the establishment of the pretrial service program. So our pretrial service officers are responsible for doing a risk assessment and making release recommendations, as well as the supervision of defendants placed on pretrial. What that means is that the court may also order electronic monitoring as part of the release conditions, as part of the supervision. The graph on the right that you'll see are how many defendants we have released are assigned to us for community supervision, just over 2,600. This was at the beginning of the month. And what I wanted to point out was that we have over 1,600 on electronic monitoring. So what that equates to is about 62% of our population that is out on pretrial is on electronic monitoring. The next slide, some of you may recall from a different committee that some of this information had been provided. I wanted to make sure that I pointed out this shows the growth in the electronic monitoring equipment that we have been utilizing. So you'll see an almost 95% growth in 3 years. We do utilize GPS bracelets. We utilize a radio frequency device that talks to a box at home, kind of like a house arrest curfew. And then we also utilize handheld alcohol detection devices. One of the things I would point out with this slide is that there are over, if you'll notice, at the start of this fiscal year, there were over 1,900 pieces of equipment on individuals. And if you go back to the previous slide that says there are 1,600 assigned to pretrial, what that means is that approximately 300 people on pretrial supervision have more than one piece of equipment on them. So a lot of times they'll have a GPS bracelet as well as a handheld alcohol device. The program was set up, wasn't set up to be a user-paid tool. So for this reason, our budget is obviously impacted by this extreme growth and the cost of this. And obviously, it goes without saying that with the utilization going up of EM pieces of equipment, so does lost and damaged equipment.
And let's see, I have a quick question, and then Co-Chair Hannon has a question, and let the record reflect that Representative McCabe joined us at 8:07 a.m. Good morning, and we're just taking questions slide by slide.
Apologize for my tardiness. Happy birthday, Representative Pachtek.
Good morning, and happy birthday. Very good. I don't believe that for a moment. So, quick question, if I might. So you're talking about a greater utilization of electronic monitoring devices. Is that just because we have more prisoners out on supervision? Are we choosing to utilize EM for more of that supervision? Is it because we have more people with multiple devices? Can you talk a little bit about the reason for that growth?
Sure. To the co-chair, I think if we had a crystal ball, we are the recipient of who the court orders to electronic monitoring. And what I think has happened with the growth, pretrial was a relatively new concept, and with the growth of pretrial then came the idea that this is a very good tool to use for folks that are out. And so we've seen obviously some growth due to COVID and more folks placed on pretrial, but I also think that it's a tool that is going to continue to be used.
Okay. Put your hand.
Thank you. So many times when we have departments before us, there are formal presentations, formal questions. This program and the division's goal being fairly new, what's going really well? And looking especially to the people who are actually delivering the services. So not just you, but so what are the best parts, its successes that you're hearing from the people who are carrying it out and from, I guess we'll call them clients who are, and what's the biggest hurdles? No constraints budget, but, what's being successful about it and what's not working?
And we've been joined by Representative Prox at 8:08 a.m.
So, because we're only 4 years in, and before we get 20 years of reflection going, I think, now's the time where we can sort of direct it before we've institutionalized how we do it, even though everything you do has to be systemically institutionalized. But, maybe first phase reflections of this isn't how we thought it would go, but here's what's working, here's what's not working with it.
So it's a great question to the co-chair, Hannon. I think that we have we validated our risk assessment, and we did that in 2019, so about 2 years in, about a year and a half, I guess, in. And so I think that our risk assessment is appropriately identifying risk levels for the courts to consider. It does, the electronic monitoring usage provides a great tool for us to be able to, and the courts to know what our defendants are doing while they're out on pretrial, and they're not taking up a hard bet, essentially. We are continuing to look. Obviously, it's a relatively new concept, like you mentioned, and as well as in Alaska, not only in Alaska, but truly nationwide. And so we are looking at what's working and what's not. And I actually just recently spoke with the National Institute of Corrections to do essentially a program assessment so we can see is it doing what it was intended to do? Are we maximizing court appearance? Are we reducing the amount of folks that are committing new crimes?
One follow-up?
Follow-up?
When you say validating the risk assessment, is that risk assessment... Tell us what the risk assessment for identifying who could be eligible for it looks like.
So, to the co-chair, the risk assessment is a two-scale risk assessment. So it is a risk assessment that will determine the likelihood of somebody to show up in court, as well as the likelihood of not committing new criminal offenses. So every person that gets charged with an offense, the pretrial service officer goes through and answers questions on this risk assessment for the individual and comes up with a score that then we provide to the court for making a recommendation. As far as validating it goes, what we are ensuring is when we had it validated in 2019 is we provided the results of the risk assessments, the questions that are being asked, and the university that did the risk assessment looked at whether or not were the questions appropriately reflecting the folks that were getting off and their risk level for the Alaska population.
Thank you.
Representative Ms. Good.
Mr. Co-Chair, this is Kelly. Representative Hannon, I think that is important to talk about too, though, as we're looking at whether or not it's working, is we are seeing folks that are put on electronic monitoring over and over again. And so that's something that the division is working with the courts on. So if someone cuts their bracelet, that's an escape charge now. And so then to go back before the courts, do a new assessment, and then be put back on EM and have that repetitive, you know, that's those that we are actually trying to work with the courts in a cooperative effort to try to bring down those numbers. So in an area that we are, that we see an area that we could do better, but that's a cooperation, right? Because they still have the right to assign EM, but that is one area that we are trying to find a better way.
Could I?
Quick follow-up, Coach Hannon.
So are you saying that even though the pretrial officer is doing what should be sort of a subjective evaluation of how you think they're going to act and how they did, the court can completely override that and say it doesn't matter that he cut his EM, we're going to assign EM again, and, you know, you're assessing it as this is a flight risk, this is a non-compliance risk, and the court goes, yep, but his offense is such that we standardly give EM for this offense, so we're going to assign it again, and even though you're sitting there, I mean, I was a teacher, and you go, it doesn't matter if you keep putting him in AP calculus, he's not going to succeed here, we don't have any evidence that he's going to be better prepared for AP calculus this round. So let's not be surprised when he again fails AP calculus because he just doesn't seem to have the skills to be able to complete this. Is that what the...
Through the co-chair, that's correct. That does happen.
Okay.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. So I'm going to change things a little bit. And I wonder how it would be if they had to pay for it. In other words, electronic monitoring, pretrial electronic monitoring seems to be a privilege, not necessarily a right, regardless of what judge assigns it. And if they had to pay for their own pretrial monitoring, $464 or $899 a day and $1,900 if you cut the bracelet off, if it would, A, if it would be possible, and B, if it, I know we would have to do some work here, and but if you could handle it internally, administratively, and B, would it be worth it? And I know that you've got other issues such as cell space and all that kind of stuff. I get that. But putting that aside, if there were enough cell space and if there were, you know, to throw them in the clink until their trial, pretrial monitoring seems to be a privilege. So why don't we bill them for it?
Through the co-chair, Representative McCabe, this is Kelly Good again. I would say that you kind of touched on the concerns this is a policy call. The policy was made by the legislature when pretrial was stood up. I would say the concerns about having a defendant pay would be that then they would be taking up a hard bed. Not all of them. I think some of them would not be put on, in a hard bed for sure. But the cost of a hard bed is definitely, it's $176 a day. And so I think that is part of the decision-making process for the policymakers. And also there's, I think, a determination of folks out on pretrial can still work and they can still, as you said, that maybe that's a benefit, but, you know, they can still work, be possibly productive members of their family. So I think there's all of those that have to be weighed.
Follow-up?
Thank you. And so that sort of goes into a different area or maybe expanded area. I wonder if the judges are putting people on pretrial monitoring because we have it, when in years past, because we don't have the beds, they would maybe be putting somebody into third-party custodianship or released on their own recognizance kind of thing. So at some point, I think the third-party monitoring becomes a little bit of a crutch. So I think there's a fine line, and maybe it's a pendulum thing that eventually we'll get to. But I still think it's a privilege for most people to be able to continue to work. And frankly, I think they ought to pay for it. I had a friend in California that had to pay for his own, alcohol, start the car-y thing, whatever it is, to blow into. So, it was totally his fault, you know, that he was the two-time DUI guy. And they made him pay for it. So I just wonder if we shouldn't be doing the same.
You want to answer his question on the OR, out on OR and stuff? to the co-chair, Representative McKay, we do believe that in the past, yes, some of those folks that are on pretrial would have been out on OR or maybe a third party in prior years. So, yes, we agree that it's all of the above.
Thanks.
Representative McCarty.
Thank you. Through the chair, that's interesting discussion because it's my understanding that they were paid for much of this pretrial piece, and I hear that from people. So I'm very concerned that this is not happening, especially for the cost for that. So I think that's something. One of the things you said was about the risk assessment, and it's my understanding that this is a national standard reliable assessment. That's done, and it's an objective assessment, not a subjective assessment. So based on these standard reliable and qualifying norms in the industry, are you saying that even though the courts see the numbers and say this is a high probability, this is not a good candidate for EM, the courts say, we're just going to go for it anyways and send them off? Is that what I'm hearing?
So through the chair to Representative McCarty, yes, in essence, but the court also has other factors they consider. This is one piece of what they consider. So the risk assessment tool is one piece of what they consider, and then there are many other factors that they are required by statute to consider as well.
Follow-up, okay. Representative McCarty.
So on the follow-up through the chair, that those people that are cutting their bracelets off and stuff like that, where are they at in the risk assessments when we come back to evaluate them and the risk assessment was done and then they did this? Did it correlate to that they should never have been given that privilege in the first place?
Through the chair to Representative McCarty, so that information is provided to the judge as well, that had happened previously or that charge has been, and then the judge has that to consider.
One more follow-up?
So that was not the question. The question is like here, I'm being go before the judge. I have a high risk assessment, but the judge determines that I should get an EM privilege. And then I go and cut my EM off, which seems to validate that the assessment was correct and I should never have been given the privilege in the first place. So are we seeing a correlation to these cutting off of the EM devices and the assessment? Or is assessment proven to be accurate here in Alaska in our objective evaluations?
So through the chair, Representative McCarty, yes, we do another assessment essentially, but there's so many different questions that are considered. It's a range of, have they committed crimes? Have they showed up to court? So even the cutting a bracelet is just one piece of considering that in the assessment score.
Director Rinkelman, if I might interject for just a moment, I think the question Representative McCarty is asking is, do we find that the people who are cutting their bracelets are the same people that we gave a high risk assessment to? Is that assessment accurate in predicting which people, when put on release, will cut their bracelets?
To the co-chair, thank you for that. There's so many factors that I think we're going to see that all over the map. I think you're going to see some that they're going to come through high, and it's probably because of all of the questions that are asked and considered before the score is done. So,
do you like one more follow-up, Representative McCarty?
Yes, I do. So the follow-up is, I'm hearing that, and I'm not quite sure if I'm hearing this, but that if we have these standard reliable objective mechanisms to say, here's this person, the probability that they're going to fulfill the EMPs here or they're not going to fulfill that. If there's some validity to this piece, but we have the courts that are unilaterally making their own, I'm going to discount that. I'm going to say, hey, I think they look like a nice person. I'll let them go. What is it that we as a legislator may need to do to say, no, you've got to follow this standard here. If they score enough in this area here, they don't get to go out and play.
Through the co-chair, this is Kelly Good again for the record. Representative McCarty, I don't know that we would have an answer today for that. That's a policy call. I guess you could always say things like if an offender cuts their bracelet so many times, they're not eligible. I mean, there are things like that that you could do. But I don't know that we could work with you on looking for ideas. I don't know that we have answers today for that. But there are certainly things that could be put into, you know, the entire review system of something like that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Representative Prox, and then we're going to go to Representative Puckettuck, and then we'll circle back for a quick comment or a question from Representative Hannon, and then I think move on, unless Representative Drummond would like a bite at the apple. Representative Prox.
Thank you, Co-Chair Sragi. The other side of the coin of electric monitoring pretrial services is that individuals are protected against excessive bail, and they have a right to a speedy trial. And how does this fit in, I suppose, to the excessive bail conversation? In other words, if you throw someone in jail, the expectation is that, well, it's proportionate to the crime, I get that, and the risk of escape, etc. But this is an alternative to that. So they can be on electronic monitoring as an alternative to being in jail. But are we letting then the trial piece of that extend? I guess there's two problems I'm thinking about. I'm thinking we might need to do some more thinking about this.
And Director Winkleman, when you answer the question, if you could just restate your name. You don't need to do your whole title, but since our record secretary is out of the room, it's very helpful. Thank you.
Excellent. For the record, thank you, Co-Chair. For the record, Jen Winkleman. Representative Prox, talking about the bail portion of it, it kind of goes to Representative McCabe's question about the user paid part of it. And so the idea was that folks could be placed onto pretrial supervision and money wasn't what was holding them in jail, that whether or not they could make bail, they could be placed on pretrial supervision. So I think in that sense, we are meeting that with regard to the excessive bail and placing them onto, whether it's electronic monitoring or pretrial supervision, of course, and we have 62% on electronic monitoring, but there's also those that are just on the supervision portion. As far as the right to a speedy trial, that, you know, it's really at the hands of the courts. And essentially, I think just in light of the last couple of years and COVID and some of the altered court operations that I would say, we are certainly seeing folks on pretrial monitoring or pretrial supervision longer than previously.
Mm-hmm. Any follow-up there, Representative Prox?
No, I'm just thinking we might be asking the wrong people. A lot of these questions might better be directed to the court system than these folks. They're just handling the gifts that are handed to them.
Co-Chair Hannon.
Thank you. Mine is more of a comment, and Representative Prox was starting to get it. You know, Representative McCabe, you referenced a friend who paid for after twice being convicted of a crime, and I think that's the fundamental difference. And, you know, I think we use EM in probation also once you've been convicted and out, and that might be the appropriate place to having people participate economically. But remembering that everyone on pretrial has simply been accused of a crime. There's been no conviction. And one of the criticisms has been previously, if you were poor and couldn't make jail, then you sat in prison, in jail, until a conviction or a dismissal where you may not have ever been convicted. So making it a cost to be accused of a crime, even if in the end you weren't convicted of anything, I think is the struggle that Representative Prox was getting to. And I think we've got to remember that the people on pretrial have not been convicted of a crime. And our obligation is to make sure that there isn't an economic advantage of how our system treats you. If you're wealthy, you get these options, but if you can't afford it, you don't have options. Our job is to make sure our policies are institutionalizing that economic disparity that exists in the world.
And you were Representative McCabe, I believe you were mentioned.
If yes, like so follow up. That's a fair point, Co-Chair Hannon, and I understand that. But by the same token, there is a matrix of questions that they go through. And maybe you weren't convicted of this crime, but if you got a rap sheet a mile long, the judges use the same determination for electronic monitoring as they would for bail hearings, whether or not you're a threat to the community, all that sort of thing. So, I mean, I get your point, and it's a really good point. And I'm just concerned that the judges are leaning on this as a crutch when there might be a better way to do it, or, you know, maybe the matrix needs to be adjusted. And frankly, I'm concerned with the cost. Like, if you're cutting your bracelet off, I think we should amend the statute. You automatically pay that. If it's $1,900, if you cut it off, the judge should charge you $1,900 for the bracelet, as well as make it a felony or increase the fees so that we don't. I mean, it's a cost to the state. It can be a huge cost. So, anyways, I understand what you're saying, but there is that matrix, and we determine whether or not they're available for electronic monitoring or not. So, the cost, you know, at the end of the day, you determine whether they can be on EM, and at the end of the day, you say, we determined that you could be on EM. Can you afford to pay it, or will you pay it, or do you want to be on EM? Maybe some people would rather sit in jail. I don't know.
Thank you for those comments. So we are 30 minutes in, and we've got one slide to go for this department. Representative McCarty, I know you want to jump in. So maybe a quick comment or question. I think the discussion is good for the committee, but we do have quite a few slides still to go between now and Thursday.
Thanks. To the chair, Co-Chair Hannah, I concur with your concerns. They're watching this whole thing of pretrial over the years in the industry that I've been involved with, and watching different people, and given that latitude of them under a charge to be able to go to work through a pretrial rather than being incarcerated until they get bail or such, this has been a good thing, I think, in a realm. But those people that are trustworthy to say, yeah, I'm going to do this and honor what the system says. And so how do we differentiate that from those that say, I'm going to be honoring it, and those that are not, and yet the community is saying, for those not so honoring individuals, I'm scared of them. Why did you let them out? Why are they given this privilege? Why is the bad, you know, kid in the playground allowed to keep on playing, is the question there. And so, you know, it's hard to determine a thermometer in the mouth of someone, say, oh, you're going to be not honoring. So what can we do, and having mechanisms? And that's interesting with Representative McCabe. You know, a felony starts, I believe, at $1,000. And so here's a $1,900 expense, and we're not putting any burden on that individual, let alone the, you know, situation of felony. That's of great concern.
Not seeing any other comments or questions. We'll continue on. Thank you.
All right. For the record, this is Jen Winkleman. And the final slide in this is the electronic monitoring is available across the state. And you can see as of the beginning of the month where we had active units across the state. You'll notice higher numbers, obviously, in the hub areas, and that is where the bulk of the EM placements are. Some of the smaller communities are monitored by the community jails or police departments, and that is a separate contract that DOC pretrial enters into for the monitoring of these folks. In the event that somebody can't, that a court orders somebody to electronic monitoring in an area that's not covered, or a response is not available, we do work with the courts and the stakeholders to say that it is not available in those areas.
And this is in no way intended to open a can of worms, but I don't see where would someone from the MATSU be managed through? Is that through Anchorage, or would that be Palmer? Or
to the Palmer? Chair through Palmer.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Palmer is in the MATSU last time I checked.
Just making sure. It's always good to clarify. All right. Not seeing any other questions or comments. Please continue.
Mr. Co-Chairman, this is Kelly Good again. So that was our electronic monitoring overview. I will tell you that at the very end of this, which will probably be Thursday now, we will touch on sentence electronic monitoring, which is a part of one of the placement options. So we put it under the placement. So I do want you to know we'll get to that. But now one of the next questions the committee had was about parole. There were two, parole board eligibility affected by COVID, and then how Alaska compares to other states in regards to parole. And for that, we have the executive director of the parole board, Jeff Edwards, on Teams, and he's joined us there. And Mr. Chairman, there's four slides, and I know you're trying to get through. Mr. Edwards provided you the process. In the first three slides, it's the process of how the board works through an individual looking to go out on parole. The last one is kind of the overview. I don't know if you would just like the committee to be able to go through the process on their own and have Mr. Edwards really deal with the last one, which is kind of, you know, going over the whole thing. I know time no, we need to get through.
Thank you for that, Deputy Commissioner. I think let's actually go through each one of those. We don't need to go in depth, but I think it would be good to go through each. Thank you.
Perfect. Then I'll turn it over to Mr. Edwards.
Good morning, committee members. For the record, my name is Jeff Edwards. I'm the executive director for the Alaska Board of Parole. Thank you for allowing me to participate today. Very interesting pretrial discussion that I've been listening to. I'm going to ask the committee to kind of fast forward to the tail end of an individual entering the criminal justice system in the paroling process or the release process. I provided an overview of our discretionary parole process in the slides. I'm not going to read each one, individual ones, but I'll touch on some highlights and where it starts and kind of where the end process is. As incarcerated Alaskans go and serve their sentence in Alaska prisons, there really is a detailed process and a formality to the entire time spent in prison, if you will. And it really starts at sentencing for our process. And what's important that's following sentencing is a document called the time accounting record. This is a very important piece of information that the board and the Department of Corrections uses, and the inmate has a reference for important dates and timelines. And one of the dates that is expelled upon completion of this document is what's called a discretionary parole eligibility date. And for the committee, I'll just say that discretionary parole is the process in which an interview or a meeting or a hearing is convened by the board with the inmate, as opposed to like a mandatory release date where there's no hearing. It's a mandated release, and the individual will be released on such dates. So this time accounting record that I'm referencing has both of those dates on there. I'll also say that not all incarcerated Alaskans are eligible for discretionary parole. It's kind of a narrow window of who is eligible, but this document tells us and the Department of Corrections who is eligible and what that date is. And it's important to note that that date is the earliest in which the board can release an individual. We can't go before that date, so that's the starting point. As we go through the process, and some of the slides later on in the presentation, we'll talk about things like case plans and risk needs. Those are very, very important to the board. The case plan is done early in the process for an individual who is serving a sentence, and we're talking about committee members. We're talking about people who are generally serving a fairly lengthy sentence in prison. So this case plan shall follow an individual throughout their term of incarceration. And the board will review this and analyze this document called the case plan at the parole hearing. It talks about risk needs, program and treatment. So the individual who is serving a prison sentence will know what their risks are. They'll know what programs they need to participate in. And it's going to be up to them if they choose to participate in those programs or not. And like I said, later on in the presentation, you'll hear more detailed information about programming and treatment's availability. So we're getting into a little bit of a timeline situation here for our parole process. We started early. I mentioned the discretionary parole eligibility date. We actually started well in advance of that date, the process for an individual. And it's usually started around 8 to 10 weeks in advance of that date as we're getting ready to visit or via Zoom participate in parole hearings. We try to go to each or have hearings at each sentence facility within the state of Alaska quarterly, so 4 times a year. Back in the next slide, talks a little bit more about timelines as we're nearing the date that the hearing will be held 6 weeks in advance. The individual has to apply via written application to the board. Not all inmates apply for discretionary parole, oddly enough, but if they're interested in the process, they have to fill out the application and submit it through their institutional parole officer to the board. And we're continuing on with the timeline. A couple of weeks before the board, the institutional parole officer has a very, very large role in the process. They complete a written document. They submit the case plans. And I also like to kind of reverse a little bit and talk about victim participation a little bit if I could. Well in advance of the hearing, the institutional parole officer will reach out to victims, victims' families, victim services units to help guide the process for victims. It can be a very stressful process for the victims and the victim's family. So there is a mechanism in place to reach to identify what the process is and how they'd like to participate. We offer a wide range of options for victims to participate in our process. They can be, well, pre-COVID, they can be in person, or we allow them to participate via Zoom. They can provide written documentation and such. So we really ask and emphasize the importance of victim participation in our process. So we have all the documentation. It's compiled by the institutional PO. Now we're getting to the actual hearing date and processes. The board reviews this documentation well in advance of the hearing. When it comes to the hearing date and time, the board convenes. I'll go over like the COVID scenarios and how we had to adjust our processes. But generally speaking, pre-COVID and post-COVID, we would actually be in each institution in front of the inmate and the participating parole officer and victims if they're participating. So we actually try to be there in person. We had to modify that slightly due to the pandemic. We have 5 board members. Well, actually, we have 4 now, but we have 5 board members that generally participate in our process. Each board member has an opportunity to ask questions and make comments at the hearing. And the next slide, we'll talk a little bit about. Am I going too fast?
No, you're actually going at a great pace. Thank you for that. But we do have 2 questions. First up, we have Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Edwards, could you reprise from when we had you before us for the budget subcommittee the number of people who sat before the parole board during the last 2 years and were awarded parole versus the pre-COVID period? My recollection is the number was sort of static, but the granting of parole was substantially down. So looking for not just the process, but the specifics of how many people went out on parole in 2021, and I guess we don't have 2022 yet. We're still there in the middle of the year.
To Co-Chair Hannon, yeah, that's a great question. It's a dynamic question. I'll be quite clear. There are significant law changes that happened. For example, in 2019, I have it right here in front of me, the board convened just over 900 discretionary parole hearings. Last year, we convened just over 200. So there's a wide variation due to the law changes that happened with SB 91 and the repeal of SB 91. Well, not repeal, but HB 49 that made discretionary parole eligibility quite limited. During SB 91, essentially, the majority of every inmate was eligible for discretionary parole, and we had to convene those hearings regardless if an inmate was wanting to appear or not. So that's how you see those numbers shift downward quite a bit in the last year in comparison to 2019. The last few years, in comparison to pre-COVID or 2010, for example, the grant rate, as you refer to, is the release of an inmate or authorized parole went down is about 16%. So an individual has 16% chance of getting parole. It's, you're right. It is down quite a lot from previous years.
Follow up, Coach Rahina.
And what I'm looking to try and determine, Mr. Edwards, is the role of program availability, because as you referenced, most inmates have things they need to complete programming, whether it's get your GED or participate in Narcotics Anonymous or sex offender treatment, whatever your programming, and trying to see where the intersect was. If we didn't have that programming available, then you weren't going to be eligible for parole when the parole board met with you and said, here are the five things you need to do, and you only completed one. And I'm trying to figure out how much was sort of that versus a parole board who just decided we're not granting parole, and we're down 16%, and making sure that the state is providing what would be perceived as the obligation of the state. If we say you've got to complete a GED, then we need to have a GED program available to you to participate in it. But I don't know how that's reflected in your data.
Thank you, Coach Rahina. If you would like, I have a slide on that. I think it's the next slide or the slide after that.
Let's maybe put a pin in that for just a moment, and then we'll proceed to that slide once it's due time. At this moment, let's go to Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So I just have one question. Thanks, Coach Rahina. Or I'm sorry, he's shruggy. The IPOs. Who do they work for? How many in each facility? These are really great slides, and I come up with a question, and then I read through, and it's answered in the slide before I get there. But this one's a little bit nebulous. I'm not real sure where, who the IPO works for, how many in each prison, that sort of thing. They would seem to be pretty important if they're putting together the risks and needs identified by their risk assessment tool and building all that up. So.
I can let Kelly Good answer that if you'd like.
Very good.
Through the co-chair, this is Kelly Good for the record. Representative McCabe, the institutional probation officers work for DOC. They actually work within the institutions. So they would report to that superintendent of that institution. Numbers-wise, I'd have to get you per facility how many we have. But they are located in the institution so that they can work with those inmates.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, on two different occasions, I hate to use the word victim, but the technical term, I was the victim. On one occasion, it was $25,000 in bad checks. On another occasion, it was $6,000 in goods and an assault charge. And in both cases, I asked the prosecuting attorney if I could be contacted whenever this was sorted out. And it didn't happen in either case. And not the end of the world, but where's the process going wrong? I would say that this process isn't working correctly in terms of victim involvement somewhere. How do they figure this out, and why aren't the victims calling contact?
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair, through the Co-Chair, this is Kelly Good again. Representative Prox, So victim notification is really important, and we agree. But there's different stages in this process. So it sounds like, to me, your victim issue was on the early end during the trial, during the indictment process. So that is, that's not yet reached DOC. So where we come in is when someone is incarcerated with us, when there are needs to notify the victim then. I think you might have heard about Vine. That's one way. That's our victim. Jen? Victim identification notification every day. Sorry, Representative Drummond, I don't have that in our acronyms here for you. I'm trying really hard. I did the acronym list at the end. Representative Prox, we have many different ways. Our probation officers, our pretrial officers, parole officers all do victim notifications once that individual is within our system. When they're outside our system, though, still in the legal system, that usually falls upon a victim notification within that legal system that I can't speak to.
Okay.
Yes, quick follow-up.
Okay, fine. I'm not blaming parole, but, fell through the cracks. What the hell's going on here? Who do you talk to? And how do you figure out, are you on the list? Can you expect a notification from the state? I didn't hear anything from the state, even on the resolution of the cases. I had to pay attention to that myself.
Representative Prox, I think we, maybe we'll have the courts come in.
Okay,
but very good. I don't think this department's prepared to speak to those issues.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, very good.
I had a rant.
And please continue, and if this next slide is on the topic of programming and that sort of thing, the line of questioning that Representative Hannon was on, then this would be a good time to address that as well. Thank you.
Okay, for the record, Jeff Edwards again, and we're on the slide that's titled COVID Effects on Discretionary Parole. So this slide indicates our effects and how we, our procedural effects. I mentioned earlier that we had to resort to a video conferencing platform. Obviously, the board members were working from home, and folks generally were not allowed entrance into the prison, so we had to come up with a process to hold our hearings, and we're very proud to say that we were able to convene all of our hearings. We weren't delayed or paused or had to take a break to figure out the technology. We were proactive in that, and we were able to effectively have all of our hearings convened based on the statutory timelines, and we were able to meet those goals. So I'm very proud of that. We didn't find, and to the co-chair Hannon's point, that although there was a pause in some programs, we didn't find that it affected our discretionary parole decision-making process. There's some data at the bottom of the slides, and I didn't get to the word precondition yet, but the preconditions are, Co-Chair Hannon spoke briefly on it. If the board sees an inmate for a discretionary parole hearing, and the decision of the board is to continue or put off the case off into the future with a precondition to complete a particular program. Say, for example, they have to complete substance abuse. We'll see you in 15 months, but you have to complete this program. So the data that we evaluated tells us that 69% of the people were able to meet that precondition during the pandemic. 29% failed to complete due to their own behavior or choice, which simply means either they had a major infraction or a write-up, or they decided to go on EM or Point McKenzie Farm or something like that. It wasn't to the department's issue of programming. It was their own personal choice as an inmate that they made. And we have one person that's still on treatment wait list. But we found, Co-Chair Hannon, that there wasn't a major obstacle for us in our decision-making process, if that's an answer to your question.
Coach Hannon, follow-up?
Okay. So, Mr. Edwards, then why do we have this substantial downturn in the number of inmates out on parole over the last decade? If we're comparing back before HB 91, you referenced 2011, where we had hundreds of people going on parole, and in 2020, only 200. If we're providing all the means, What's the parole board finding that leads them to conclude so many fewer are eligible for parole?
Well,
or being granted parole, not eligible. Being granted parole. I apologize.
Okay. Yeah. Coach Aaron, yeah, that's a good question. Eligibility, as you clarified, did not, it changed the legislation, but the granting of parole that did decline, we're really taking a close look at that. We didn't get to one of the slides that talks about the decision-making criteria that's mandated by the legislature, and there's four decision-making criteria that each board member has to consider for each individual case. And we have to evaluate those criteria, whether or not inmates are meeting those criteria. Certainly throughout the years, the board members, it changes, right? The board, different people get appointed to the board. This particular board has a strong priority of public safety, and their release decisions are, they're taken very, very seriously. And whether or not releasing an individual would diminish the seriousness of the offense, or whether or not they've done what they needed to do as far as institutional infractions go. So they're evaluating whether or not releasing this individual early would be any kind of a risk to public safety, and I think that they're taking a very, very strong, close look at that.
One more follow-up?
So one of the things I've heard, and I'm hoping you can verify or I'm hoping to dispel, is that this parole board in the last two-year cycle, generally, when they denied someone parole, also said, you cannot apply again for another 10 years. And my understanding is that previously it was standardly said 5 years. And I'm wondering if you can verify that to be a process that the parole board of the last 2 years has standardly done, and what does that mean? Because I think for us, when we look at the budget, that means that we would be expecting fewer people to be released from hard beds over the next, 10 years, and we are going to see an increase in the need for more hard beds because fewer people are going to be going out on parole, because if they've been told by the parole board they can't even be put forward again for 10 years, then we know that you're not getting out in five. You're going to be here another 10.
And before we go to Executive Director Edwards, I am going to briefly pass the gavel over to my co-chair. I've got another obligation. I'm hoping to be back prior to the end of the committee hearing, but I will pass the gavel until such time as I return. And I've got Representative McCabe next.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Edwards.
Thank you. For the record, Jeff Edwards again, Co-Chair Hannon. So the law states that if the board makes a decision to deny parole, they're not obligated to put any kind of limit on that. Now, we have developed an internal policy with the parole board. If an individual has a sentence that's long enough that if we deny parole, we would see that person again in 10 years, or they would have an opportunity to reapply in 10 years. So it wouldn't be, we're not just saying deny, serve 40 more years until your mandated release date. And it was a one-time deal. You missed it, and it's forever. So we put in a limit in place of 10 years. The five-year thing, we've never done that. And this 10-year policy that I'm talking about has been in place for years, ever since I've been with the board for 12 years now. So it's been there for quite some time. And we just view it as another opportunity for an individual to come back before the board and have another hearing without being set off. Essentially for decades, if you will.
Okay. Representative McCabe.
Thank you for that. So a couple of clarifications for me. I heard you say that there were 900 hearings in the years prior to COVID, and in 2020 there were 200 hearings. Did I hear that wrong, or is that number of people granted parole?
Those are the number of cases that came before the board.
So there were 900 hearings and 200 hearings. So I think.
Madam Co-Chair, Kelly Good for the record. I think Mr. Edwards mentioned also Representative McCabe. That was when the law changed, not necessarily COVID.
Okay.
Okay. And Mr. Edwards, will you confirm that, please?
Yes, that is absolutely correct.
Follow up?
Follow up. Go ahead.
Thank you. So there was a number of hearings. There was 900 hearings, and then the law changed, and now there was 200 hearings. And you said that there was a percentage of those, a greater percentage were denied parole of the 200 versus the 900. That's what I heard anyways. And I'm wondering if that's true. I'm wondering how much the video conferencing you think made a difference versus a in-person parole hearing. In other words, parole board's all sitting, there's a bunch of TVs, they can't see the emotion, they can't hear the emotion necessarily. Video conferencing changes things a little bit, and I'm wondering, it seems like we're trying to pin this on the parole board, and whether it be the 900 versus 200 or the percentage-wise, and I'd like to dispel that notion, or at least that's my goal. You can say yes or no.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, we actually evaluated and analyzed that to the best we could. It's very difficult to say yes or no that video conferencing was a major factor in the denial rate of parole. I'm guessing it probably played a small role. The board has always contended that their primary objective is to be there in person, to sit across the table and look at the mannerisms, how they're behaving, how they're talking. It's a nerve-wracking process. They understand that, but there really is some value to sitting before somebody and making these serious release decisions. But we had to do what we had to do. It was the best option we could come up with. We didn't have media personnel that could facilitate these hearings. We had to do it on our own. So it was a challenge, as you're referencing, but we did the best that we could during the pandemic. Our plan is to go back to the person hearings after this is all said and done.
Representative McCabe, go ahead.
Thanks, Co-Chair Hannon. So I appreciate that. So maybe just to sort of put a nail in this coffin, so to speak, to the best of your knowledge, it was there was no difference in the parole board in the last 2 years versus previous years in how they treated the cases, whether it be from COVID or HB 49, 91, any of those kind of deals. It's just sort of the normal course of things.
Through the co-chair, Representative McCabe. Yes, I would agree with that.
Thank you.
And Mr. Edwards, since you mentioned it and you said there is a plan to return to in-person parole, board hearings, could you tell us when you're expecting that? To return to in-person parole board hearings.
Representative Co-Chair Hammond, that is a great question. We plan to work with the department on how that looks. We hope to get there sooner than later. And I think Ms. Good probably has a better understanding of what the department's looking at as far as allowing outside agencies to come in on a regular basis, if that's
Good. She has her hand up.
Madam Co-Chair, for the record, Kelly Good again. Representative Hannon, we are open. So since we were here the last time, all of our facilities are out of outbreak. We've been able to reopen contractors and whatnot. So it is, as long as a facility doesn't have, any major COVID issue, we anticipate the parole board can come back in and do their hearings.
Thanks.
So the answer is now. Okay.
Thank you.
Yep.
I have a question.
Representative McCarty, go ahead.
To the chair, something was brought up, and if you could explain this, on page 10, that last section there, the board was mindful of programming interruptions and so on. You made a comment that the 2% appeared to represent one person, which seems to imply that this is reflecting only 50 people. So am I doing the math correctly?
Through the co-chair to Representative McCarty, this population that I'm referencing were only those inmates who had preconditions. So these are just a select group of the individuals that were granted or not granted parole.
Okay.
So the precondition is the catalyst for this group.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Nice job. Thanks.
Okay. Ms. Good, I'm going to ask you a question that's not on this since we went to, since all facilities are currently open, nobody's in outbreak, parole's restored. Can you tell me currently what our visitation is for all facilities? Are they open and do we have restored contact visits or are there still restrictions on visits to inmates?
Through the chair, this is Kelly Good again, to the chair. Visitation's open. Contact visit is not yet in all facilities, but visitation is open. As a matter of fact, I was just out at our local Lemon Creek yesterday, and I asked how visitation was going, and surprisingly, it's open and people are showing up, but we are not seeing the surge of visits yet, and we anticipate that that will grow as people get more comfortable also coming back in, families as well, for their own COVID risks, as you know. But, yeah, it's open, but contact not quite yet is the last I understand. And if Ms. Brooks behind me will shake her head, yes? Okay, yes. So, but that's next. Hopefully we'll get to contact visiting soon.
Thank you. Mr. Edwards, I think you're off the hot seat for the moment. Thank you for joining us this morning. I'm sure it takes away from the piles of things that you have to do, but we appreciate you being willing to indulge our inquiries.
Thank you very much for allowing me to participate.
All right. I think the next section is overtime information.
Madam Co-Chair, this is Kelly Good again. I'm going to invite Director Wilkerson to the table. The committee asked the question, correctional officer and department staff overtime for overview. So we have two slides for that discussion, and I'll turn it over to Director Wilkerson.
Good morning. For the record, my name is April Wilkerson. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections. I'm going to start on slide 12. This is a slide representing the question that was asked. For FY21, the total overtime hours worked were 337,817, broken out into these categories. I do want to point out that the critical support staff that's reflected, that's going to be the maintenance, the food, the laundry workers, our administrative staff, our criminal justice technicians, criminal justice planners, all of the support staff that are there and are essential workers to help support the operations of the department, including our central office and our executive management team as well. In FY21, personal services made up 61% of the budget in FY21 for a total expenditure of $242,613,000. And our overtime was about 7.5% of our total personal service expenditures. Moving on to slide 13, the primary drivers that really drive our overtime, DOC is a 24/7 operations. We don't have the luxury of setting aside the work. So the work's there. If we have vacancies, if we have leave, these are just some of the items, the high priority items that drive the overtime that is incurred within the department. Our minimum staffing for security post, our essential health care coverage, our food workers, Lemon Creek right now has no food workers. We have entered into an emergency contract. We have a vendor that is providing food services. 2 weekends ago, it was our superintendent and our assistant superintendent that were providing food services at that facility. In Wildwood, a couple months ago, down in Kenai, it was our administrative officer that supervises the kitchen and her staff, her administrative staff, that were assisting the food worker because of COVID. So while we have inmate workers, we still need that oversight for each of those areas. So we just really wanted to put out there that some of the drivers are just beyond our control, and we're doing the best that we can. We're working to get our positions filled, appropriately filled, so we don't take a correctional officer off the floor to fill in for the records or the food or that maintenance that is needed in an institution.
Ms. Wilkerson, if you go back a slide where you were talking about the percentages, and 7.5% was your overtime from personnel services, which is your biggest component in your budget. Pre-COVID, what was, in an annual basis, what did you plan for? Because you're the numbers section, and I'm sure that you always had some overtime, but what was it in a pre-COVID life on an annual basis?
To the chair, Representative Hannon, we have seen an increase over the last couple of years, but it's budgetarily, we don't have a large budgeted overtime. We have a pretty hefty vacancy rate, even though we're 24/7 and we are trying to fill all of our positions. And so we use our the funding from the vacant positions to support our overtime cost. So on average, our premium pay has been budgeted just under 2%. And of that, the overtime, because that premium pay includes our graveyard shift, our holiday hours that are worked, and then the overtime from excess hours. So it's difficult to say, you know, that how that compares. But we have seen our overtime growing with COVID. Department of Administration has negotiated compensatory leave into the contract. So we do have staff that will work overtime, not get paid. It goes into a compensatory bucket, and then they have leave to use it a future. It hasn't caught on across the board, but it does kind of help offset. So when we looked at our FY20 and 21 overtime hours in our expenses, we saw the increases, but it was still pretty stable when you're looking at the hours. But again, that's because the compensatory time wasn't added in. And do you want to add anything?
Thank you. Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Co-Chair Hannon. So sometimes... I do know that I've talked to some of the DOC officers, union folks, who say that they are overworked and work too many shifts and work too long. And I've talked to others of them that are like, bring it on, I need the money, I'd love to. So I recognize that it's a fine line for you, and COVID had to throw a huge wrinkle in any kind of, planning that you had. So, I guess what I'm asking is, say we could fund normal working for all DOC employees, so they work their 8-hour, 40 hours a week, whatever it was, think they'd be happy? I bet there'd be a percentage of them that weren't too happy with that.
Through the chair to Representative McCabe, I think I've worked with this budget since 2001, and I've seen institutions that are fully filled. We're always going to have overtime. We're always going to have that hospital transport. We're always going to have that, the leave, or we're covering because there's been turnover. But what I would also add is we see officers that will sign up because of the overtime opportunities at other facilities. Right now, we see less of that because of where we're at in our staffing status right now. But if we were to become more appropriately staffed, I think that those individuals that want the overtime will always be able to get the overtime. And those that really want their home life and that equitable professional career will be able to maintain that.
Just one follow-up. Thanks, Co-Chair Hannon. So I think I heard you say something in there that interests me. Do you mean like a officer at the work farm can sign up for overtime at Goose Creek or whatever it is out there, so he can actually work within the DOC but at two separate facilities and catch overtime? That's interesting. Cool. Thanks. She said yes for the clerk. She was nodding her head.
The chair to Representative McCabe. The answer is yes. Our overtime for our correctional officers is based on seniority, and they can sign up on that list.
Cool.
I would add right now, out of Seward, our superintendent puts out a notice on a regular basis right now, just because of the staffing levels in Seward, to offer overtime down in that facility.
Nice.
Thank you. Since you're going there, and you know, McKenzie Work Farm to Palmer short commute. So when the superintendent in Seward, since you brought it up, are they advertising that to COs in other parts, so that instead of just your 1 week or 2 week shift, instead of going on your 2 weeks off and taking them off, you're taking them off at your duty station, but you're coming to Seward and working 2 weeks there?
No, through the chair. To the co-chair, thank you for allowing me to be able to clarify. That overtime is done on the officer's RDO, regular day off,
right.
And so they're not pulled from another facility to fill in another.
Right, but they're potentially coming from another facility and
yes,
banking on, I've got to pay college tuition for my kid this year, so I'm going to take every overtime shift I can find. And
that is correct.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, this is Kelly Good for the record again. We have moved on quite nicely today.
Wonderful.
We are going to enter programming and reentry, which I'm sure has quite a few questions. The question posed by the co-chairs was rehabilitation programs and operational status of the programs in the facilities. And for this discussion, I'm going to turn it over to Director Laura Brooks.
Good morning. For the record, Laura Brooks, Director of Health and Rehabilitation Services for the Department of Corrections. You'll hear us refer to that division as HARS. So on the following pages, well, let me start with just reiterating, we are out of outbreak status in all of our facilities. So what that means is not only are we open for visitation, but we also have welcomed back contractors, volunteers, reentry coalition folks, community case managers, and such for reentry efforts. So although those programs aren't 100% back up and running, simply because it's taking contractors and such time to get either restaffed or reorganized to come back in, we are open for that. And some of those programs are, again, up and running already, and we expect that they will be fully operational very shortly. So the Division of Health and Rehabilitation Services covers physical health care, as you know, but for today we're going to cover the other sections of this division, mental health services, substance abuse treatment, sex offender treatment, domestic violence or batterers intervention programs, and then education and vocation. We do have a statutory and constitutional requirement or responsibility to provide physical health care and also the mental health services. And so on this first slide, you'll see kind of a general picture of the different services that we do provide. 65% of our offender population have a diagnosable mental health disorder. We are the largest provider of mental health services in the state of Alaska. 22% of those have what we call a serious and persistent mental illness, which would be something as serious as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, those types of diagnoses. And then when you add substance abuse into that, we're looking at about 80% of our population are qualified to be mental health trust beneficiaries. And then we also recognize that about 75% of our female population have sexual assault histories, sexual victimization histories, my apologies. And so what we do, we have psychiatrists, we have psychiatric nurse practitioners, and then we have mental health clinicians in most of our facilities. We do have one facility that doesn't have on-site services. That would be Bethel, our Yukon-Kuskokwim Correctional Center. We've been unable to find mental health clinicians in that area to either contract or work for the department. So over the last year or so, couple of years, we have instituted telework or telepsychiatry for those individuals in that facility who need mental health services. So we have a mental health clinician who meets with them and provides the services they need through our tele system. We focus on evidence-based interventions, typically using cognitive behavioral interventions for this population. And we address everything from crisis intervention, which might be somebody who's acutely suicidal or floridly psychotic, to somebody who is having difficulties adjusting to incarceration. We don't do 50-minute therapy like you might find in the community, but we do try to make sure that those individuals who come to us leave us in better shape than when they came to us in the first place. The majority of our resources over the years have really focused down on crisis intervention and stabilization. And that is simply because we are seeing a much, much more acutely ill population than what we've seen before. They're coming in younger and more sick, than I've seen in my 25 years here. Much of that, I think, is contributed by the street drugs that are further complicating their psychiatric or their mental health picture. Let's see.
And before you move on, I have a question, and then I'd like to go to Co-Chair Hannon. Just of these services listed on this slide, were the majority of them paused or severely reduced capacity during the pandemic? And then can you just speak briefly to what portion of these are kind of back up at full capacity, or are most of them still pretty severely hindered? Thank you.
To the co-chair, most of these services were not stopped during COVID. These are some acutely ill individuals that we work with. And so there was no stopping the kind of care that they needed. We did slow down groups, some of the groups that I mentioned, like adjusting to incarceration, some anxiety groups, even some of the folks who weren't perhaps acutely depressed or suicidal. We had groups for those individuals. What our mental health clinicians ended up doing was they would round on the units and do more one-on-one interactions with them instead of having people come together in a group. We provided a lot of self-study information to the individuals, really what we had to do in those cases was just increase our one-on-one. But in terms of the treatment on the psychiatric units, on the next page you'll see we have several acute care psychiatric units and even subacute psychiatric units throughout our system. We didn't pause the services on those at all. There was no ability to do that.
And a quick follow-up from myself. Are any of these services heavily reliant on vendors or contractors to deliver, or are most of these in-house?
To the co-chair, most of these are done in-house. As I said, we have psychiatrists and psychiatric nurse practitioners who provide the medication management, and then our mental health clinicians are on-site. We do have a couple of facilities where we don't have the volume that would require a 40-hour clinician, places like Nome, Ketchikan, where those are contractual services. So we do have some of the mental health services that are provided by contract.
Okay, and I've got Co-Chair Hannon, I've got Representative McCabe, and I've got Representative McCarty. So Co-Chair Hannon.
So I have two questions. The first one should be pretty easy. What's Title 47 management?
To the co-chair, so Title 47s, there's two types of Title 47 holds. These are non-criminal holds. So these are individuals who come to us either because of their mental health, their serious mental health needs where they are awaiting transport to a bed at API, or there's the alcohol holds where someone has been picked up in the community who are so incapacitated by their alcohol or their substance use that they're at risk in the community. Those are 12-hour holds. So those individuals are given 12 hours once they become sober and we deem them safe to go, we release them back to the community, and then the mental health holds are dependent upon the bed availability at the psychiatric hospital.
Okay.
Follow-up?
So my most significant question, I've heard many of the stats before about the percentage of our population that is diagnosed illness, serious persistent mental health. I had not heard that 75% of our female populations are all identified as victims of sexual assault, speaking to the trauma, knowing that Alaska is a state with the highest rates of sexual assault. Is that statistic comparable in other states, or is ours significantly different?
Yes.
So in other states with lower rates of sexual assaults, perhaps, is their female population still reflected in a very you know, 75% is most of our women who end up in the criminal justice system have had significant trauma of a sexual nature in particular in their background. Is that true across the nation or?
To the co-chair, I don't actually have national numbers for corrections. I can speak anecdotally. When I do attend national meetings, like through the National Coalition of Correctional Healthcare or the ACA, American Correctional Association, there's a lot of discussion about the need for trauma treatment for both the female and the male population. I didn't mention the male population, but we have a fairly high number of male prisoners who have experienced sexual assault as well. I just don't have the statistics for that. It's significantly underreported, as I think folks would understand. But we do have the highest incidence of sexual assault in the country. And so it would, to me, it would seem that that translates to the victims that we have in our custody.
Okay, Representative McCabe.
Thank you. So I'm aware that, because I was part of the church that was doing it, but back when Palmer was running before, they had this community involved, called it the God Pod, I think. So I'm wondering how, in your 25 years of experience, how you think those kinds of things, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a faith-based sort of sponsored event. It could be an Alcohol Anonymous kind of pod or something like that. How effective are those? I seem to me that, and we were sort of patting ourselves on the back a little bit, but it seemed to me like the God Pod at Palmer, the recidivism and the ability of the people coming out of there when they got reintroduced, because invariably they came to our church, was pretty good. But what's your perspective?
Through the co-chairs to Representative McCabe. So we provide a lot of programming that is not necessarily treatment. And actually, I shouldn't even call it. We provide a lot of activities, things like that, that are there are a lot of side benefits to that. Someone might look at, you know, some of the activities that we do and think, why on earth are we doing that in a correctional center? There's a couple of reasons for that. One is a busy inmate is less likely to get into trouble while they're incarcerated. And we're also trying always to re-socialize them and to provide them with mentors and people who maybe for the first time in their life provide them with a role model. And I'm a little hesitant always to tie recidivism numbers back to one particular program because there are a number of significant criminogenic needs that when the more of those that we address, the more likely those individuals are to be successful. But I would certainly say that one of the things that TLC, and that's the Transformational Living Community, one of the things that that does is it brings them together, it provides them with mentorship, guidance, and a whole number of other skills intended to address their criminogenic needs when they get out. So we are very pleased to be able to provide a wide variety of those services.
Well, do you think that was effective, the TLC? And that's the first time I've ever heard criminogenic needs. I'm going to have to go look that up.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat your question?
So the question is are they effective? Are they effective for you with the population in there and helping them with their mental health issues? And are they effective? In a few percentage reduction in recidivism would be a great thing for us, you know, the budget people, you know, so mm-hmm. I'm curious.
Yeah, through the chair, absolutely. I mean, the programming that we provide, including the TLC, really, we try to focus on those criminogenic needs. And just their ability to function sometimes in these groups, to complete something when maybe they've never completed anything before, that provides them with a really good foundation for when they leave.
For the record, that was Director Brooks. Just a gentle reminder to put yourself on the record. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Next up, Representative McCarty.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. So through the chair. So the premise of the treatment is evidence-based. The evidence-based is based on empirical studies to show efficacy thereof. Our DOC is a classic example of having an empirical study ability with control groups and stuff like that. So what are we doing to actually recording these different things? Like as Representative McKee brought up, it's like seeing what is evidence-based, because I'm just going to throw this out here, but the question is there. It's like if we have some programs coming in that are not efficacious, then why waste the time if we are showing that? Or are they just getting money from the state and keep on doing this because they happen to know somebody in the state?
Through the chair to Representative McCarty, thank you for that question, because over the last probably 5 years particularly, we have made a very concerted effort to adjust our curriculum in each one of these areas to make sure it is evidence-based programming. We have trained our staff in cognitive behavioral interventions, which, as you know, is an evidence-based approach, and has been found most efficacious for the criminal justice population. And so when we do bring in a new curriculum, we are making sure that it is one that has been normed for our population. We're making sure that it is one that is appropriate to the criminal justice population. And so we have shifted many of our programs and changed the curricula over the last 5 to 6 years to make sure that we absolutely are following an evidence-based approach.
Follow-up?
So with follow-up here is that SAMHSA guidelines for evidence-based does allow for independent empirical studies, or, you know, seeing for that, even if there's a bit of an anecdotal type component to that. So one of the uniquenesses of that is it allows for a situation like in Alaska where we're not doing this long-term longitudinal study that we're seeing efficacy from within. So we don't have to wait to see what Texas is doing or what other states doing. Are we seeing any of these type of studies, these type of outcomes within our own to show efficacy like in Nome or efficacy in Bethel or efficacy in Highland?
Through the chair to Representative McCarty, Laura Brooks for the record. We use a number of programs that are SAMHSA approved, and that's the substance abuse. Mental health services. Yes, that. And so we do use a number of their programs that they have certified for this population. And then also through a grant, we are bringing in a group to evaluate the current programming that we have. We plan to do that every few years to make sure that we are following that program the way it was designed. It needs to be done to the fidelity of the model, meaning that we make sure that our staff are trained to deliver it in the method in which it was intended, to make sure it is following whatever guidelines it was, whatever it was normed on, all of that. So we do have a group coming in. It was actually supposed to come in last year, but because of COVID, that got delayed, to evaluate all of the programs that we do have now to make sure that they are doing what they're intended to do. And if they're not, we'll take a look at do we need to change to a different model.
Okay. One last follow-up.
So
with that in psychotropic medications, so I'm hearing from a number of inmates where the psychotropic medications that they normally got, they're not getting while incarcerated. Are we having just a challenge because the burden is on DOC for the medication, because they're not, like in the hospital situation where they are under Medicaid, if they are out of the facility for 24 hours here, they're in the facility, not leaving. What's our situation with the medication?
So through the chair to Representative McCarty, there's actually a number of factors that play into that. One of the big things is that we are in a unique situation where we're able to observe somebody 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to see just how are they doing. And so we sometimes do change the medications that they were taking in the community, because not only are we not seeing some of the issues that they may have seen or reported to their provider in the community, but there's also different things happening in our system that sometimes their circumstances have changed and they don't need that level of medications. The other thing is we are not going to provide narcotics to our inmate population. So they're not going to be getting the sedatives, those types of things in our system. We will provide them with evidence-based interventions to help them deal with things like anxiety that may be out in the community. They might be taking something like Xanax for, but we don't provide that type of medication to the inmate population. There's a high incidence of abuse and redistribution, shall we call it, amongst the inmate population, so that's not something that we're going to allow to come in. But we do try to make sure that they have other ways to address those mental health needs if we're not going to provide them with that kind of medication.
Okay, not seeing further questions on this slide. Please continue.
Thank you. On slide 16, this is where our psychiatric unit.
Laura Brooks.
I'm sorry. My apologies, Laura Brooks, for the record. You heard me speak about our psychiatric units. Our acute care psychiatric units, we have one for men in Anchorage and one for women out at Highland Mountain. These are 24-hour hospital-level care psychiatric units that are staffed with psychiatrists, mental health clinicians, correctional officers who are trained in mental health and psychiatric nurses. I don't know if I mentioned that. And so these are the two locations where our most ill population reside. These are the folks who are acutely suicidal, very psychotic when they come to us. And these are really more stabilization units as much as they are treatment units. Our goal is to then transition them to a subacute care unit. And that's where we have folks who maybe can't function well in general population. Maybe out in the community, they'd be living in an assisted living home. And so we transition them to that subacute care unit. And many of those then do end up transitioning back to general population. But we have over 340 beds dedicated to this severely mentally ill population.
So before we go to Representative McCarty, I'll quickly jump in here. So I seem to remember news reports of folks that are in crisis being housed in hospital rooms or even jail cells without receiving health care. I seem to recall these reports from these stories in the last year to two. Can you talk at all about that? I mean, 28 seems like a fairly low capacity at times. Is that sufficient to meet the needs? And could you talk at all about that? Am I misremembering stories from the news?
To the co-chair, I'm not sure what exactly you're referring to. There has been some attention paid to those Title 47 non-criminal holds that we spoke about earlier. There was a decision made in the courts about 2 years ago that changed the way that those were handled from the hospital side of things, where they are required now to get them to the hospital within 24 hours instead of having someone who has not committed a crime sit in a jail waiting for a hospital bed. But as far as this is concerned, as far as the criminal holds that we have, I would say I think we could always do more for these individuals. It tends to be, it's a very high needs population. We are working to keep our programming, as Representative McCarty indicated, making sure it's very effective and that we're meeting the needs of the most ill. In the time that I've been with the department, unfortunately, what I've seen is more of the need has shifted to more of a crisis intervention type of model than a longer term kind of treatment, simply because of the numbers that we have and because of the really ill people that we have coming through our front door. Many of these are pretrial defendants. And so our ability to treat them is a little bit complicated. There was a case a number of years ago, a national case, where we're no longer able to treat a pretrial defendant who's gravely disabled. That was the Lochner case out of, I think it was Colorado. And so we do get a number of pretrial folks who are with us who we do struggle to provide the appropriate level of treatment for, but that partially is because our hands are a little bit tied. Oh, and that not just pretrial, but unsentenced.
Okay, thank you. Representative McCarty.
Thank you, through the chair, and I think you answered that. Put in another term of the topic you care would be a stabilization, where the other one is a sub-stabilization. The percentages on the average, what do you see, and you have to call the whole breakdown, but what do you see of the beds being filled?
Through the chair to Representative McCarty, they're always filled, all of them.
So the capacity is 100%, and okay.
That's correct.
Thank you.
So if I might jump in, because I seem to be slowly piecing my memory back together, and I seem to recall it being API not having capacity, and therefore those that would normally go to API were being held by corrections. So can you talk a little bit about the interplay there, or the interconnection there with API, and then if your beds are always full, I mean, how is the department dealing with that situation? Is it still present? Can you talk about that? Thank you.
For the record, this is Laura Brooks, to the co-chair. So that really is what I was mentioning, where previously, prior to the Morse decision, Judge Morse, we were seeing individuals stay with us for many days, sometimes many weeks, waiting on a bed at API. As I know you're all aware, there's been plenty of coverage on the API situation, and that's not my area. What I can tell you is that collaboratively, we've worked with DHSS very hard to make sure that those individuals who do not have criminal charges and are awaiting a bed at API, that they go as soon as possible. And if they're on the, and that has changed significantly since that decision. Most of these individuals are going right away to API within that 24 hours. Sometimes there's some things that derail that for a variety of reasons, but we do work with the hospital to make sure that we can get them there just as soon as possible, because I don't think anybody wants somebody without any criminal charges sitting in a jail bed.
Okay. Thank you very much, Director Brooks. That's very helpful. Co-Chair Hannon.
Thank you, Ms. Brooks. So putting aside the Title 47 holds, now I got the term for it, but knowing that you are always at full capacity for subacute, what's the demand within our sentence population? You know, if we doubled the number of beds in subacute psychiatric units, would we still have them fully occupied? We know that prison is the largest placement and deliverer of mental health services. And we're clearly not doing a very good job of the trauma effect slope that leads or contributes to many people ending up in prison. But what's our demand for those services? Would it, you know, if we doubled it, the capacity, would it still be full?
To the co-chair, I think right now, on any given day, we might have 10 to 15 men waiting for a bed at our unit in Anchorage for the acute care. We might have 4 to 5 women waiting around the state. If we were to double our capacity, I think we would be able to shift back from a crisis intervention model to serving them more, more effectively, quite frankly, because sometimes what we see is we take somebody out of that acute care unit, we put them in a subacute unit, and they're not ready. But we had to do that because we have somebody sitting in a booking cell at Matsu pretrial who needs that acute bed space. So it's quite a shell game, really, to be moving folks around and providing that to the most critical needs when, in fact, we're moving them maybe too quickly to a subacute unit. So if we were to have more bed space, we could provide more treatment where we stabilize them and then provide treatment so that they are really ready to go to the next stage rather than perhaps moving some of them before they're ready.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
Okay, Laura Brooks for the record. On page 17, these are our substance abuse treatment overview. We have, as soon as folks walk in the door, we're looking at them for what are their substance abuse needs, what's their history, do we need to involve medical right from the beginning because there's a potential for detox during that first number of days in custody. And from that point, we then move on to screening them and referring them to substance abuse providers to look at what level of care do they need. As I mentioned, we have about 80% of our population who have substance issues that we work very hard to try to address while they're in custody. All of those services, the majority of the in-custody services are provided by contractors. We have, on the next page, you'll see the locations of those programs. But we do have RSAT, which is our residential substance abuse treatment programs. We have intensive outpatient substance abuse treatment programs, and I want to clarify that doesn't mean they leave the jail or the prison for that. When we have a residential substance abuse program, that is a mod that is dedicated to those individuals. So if at like out in the community, if they were to go to Aquila or Clitheroe and live there, in our facilities, we have residential mods where those are the only individuals who are on that mod. They live there. It's a treatment community. And then the intensive outpatient, again, they don't leave the facility, but they live throughout the facility and come to one location for the classes. It's a lower level, obviously, than the residential program. And then we also have co-occurring disorder programs, which are for those individuals who have substance use disorders and also mental illness. So that's a special curriculum directed at that population. And then the lowest level, primarily we do this for those individuals who are either pretrial unsentenced or those who are not yet ready for treatment, but those are psych ed. And so that's a lot of education about substance use, about treatment, and trying to get them maybe prepared for a higher level should they need that. So we also, actually back on the previous slide, you'll see we have a range of services to AA and NA meetings, all the way up to medication-assisted treatment, which includes things like Vivitrol upon release, providing those who come in on methadone treatment. We take them out to methadone clinics so that they can continue that. We bridge that while they're with us as the unsentenced population. And then we also subscribe to the harm reduction model. So part of what we do for that is provide individuals with Narcan kits when they leave. All of our facilities, as individuals are walking out the door, we'll offer that to them, no questions asked, whether they're taking that for themselves or because they're going back into an environment where they know there's a potential for somebody to overdose, friend or family. We provide that that Narcan kit to them through a grant that DHSS has.
Okay, Representative McCarty.
A couple questions to the chair. One is, when they come in, are you able to do a full metabolic panel looking for all sorts of drugs as well as nutrition type components as well as missing of psychotropic medications if they're supposed to be on that?
For the record, Laura Brooks, through the chair to Representative McCarty, we don't do that. We do a pretty thorough intake on these individuals, but it's inmate report. It's by their report.
Okay, so
follow up.
So is there a reason why we can't do that? Is it some things that on our statutes that don't allow for that, or just not doing it, or is a funding thing?
Through the chair, we don't have the resources for that. An individual who comes in, the booking process just for the nursing staff takes anywhere from 20 to 40 minutes to complete that on a compliant offender. And so to add additional things like that, we simply don't have the resources to do that. Our booking facilities are exceptionally busy places, and so that's not an option for us there. So what we do instead is we ask those inmates about their substance abuse history. We ask for their records. We get records from the community. And then we refer them to somebody to come in and do a more in-depth either screening or a full-on assessment for those individuals,
okay,
if they're willing.
Please. Yep.
For the record, Kelly Good, through the chair, Representative McCarty, I also just want to remind medical care is really their choice too. So upon, as she mentioned, compliancy, whether or not they would want to give us, right, a blood draw in order to run something like that would also be, we don't know how they would react to that.
Follow up?
So if they were willing to give that there, would DOC be willing to pursue that as you're looking at stabilization? And if the stabilization is impacted because the person is spun off on some drugs or they're not stabilized with a psychotropic medication or it reveals something else that in the case of care that you have that available there. I'm hearing that big theme of stabilization and we don't know what's the etiology for the unstable individual and we have a controlled situation where we could actually do some quick assessing. With technology, we were able to do those things. So I'm wondering about that.
Sure. Through the chair, Laura Brooks for the record, Representative McCarty. So really the etiology is secondary to the symptoms. So when we look at somebody who comes in where there's the potential for detox, we are right away looking at we're looking for the symptoms. So when we're looking at somebody who is detoxing, we're putting them on detox protocols because of what we're seeing in their vital signs, what we're seeing in their behavior and things like that. The actual specific drug of choice isn't as critical as what it is that our medical staff are seeing. And so we have very, very detailed clinical protocols to address those symptoms as they come up. And so back to your original question of even if they were compliant, again, we're treating the symptoms and we do not have, our medical staff do not have the time or the resources to add something like that to our very long list of things that we go through at booking.
Thank you. Please continue. And actually, before we do, similar to my prior question, of these programs listed on the prior slide, are most of these, half of these paused, or many of these paused during the pandemic? Are they all, of those that were paused, are they all back online? And to what level are we relying on vendors for these?
Laura Brooks, for the record, to the chair. So all of our substance abuse treatment programs, the intensive outpatient and the residential substance abuse treatment, those are provided by contractors. We do have substance abuse counselors in our facilities. We also do have, we've now placed some substance abuse counselors in some of our probation offices. And those are a mix of DOC staff and contractors, depending on the location. We did suspend much of this programming during COVID. We were able to start the residential substance abuse treatment back up a little bit earlier because when we were trying to mitigate the spread of COVID, we treated housing modules as a household. So those are the people who ate together, came out, and did things together. So if we had a residential substance abuse treatment mod, it made sense to go ahead and provide that service since they already lived together. The ones that were suspended were things like the intensive outpatient where they had to go between mods, and that posed too high a risk at that point. We continued with, obviously, the screening at intake. We continued the methadone, the medication-assisted treatment. We continued the assessments. We just created wait lists. Now those programs have been reopened, and they are ramping back up very quickly. We have the great benefit of having opened one up at Palmer Correctional Center. So that actually has, because that wasn't available pre-COVID, that has actually helped us quite a bit with our wait lists, because folks who were backed up on those wait lists not only went back to the programs that we originally had, but we now have programs out at Palmer as well. So that's helped on that area. So,
and of these programs listed on the slide, are any of them at less than, say, 50% of pre-COVID delivery?
To the chair, I think some of them right now probably are because we only opened back up this last month. And so it is taking a bit of time for the contractors to get folks back in and so on. But I don't think it will be very long at all, days, weeks, before we're back at capacity.
Okay, thank you. And we've just heard the bells ring, but I also know that we still have quite a few slides, and I'd like us to be able to ask any questions on Thursday that members might have. So let's try to get through another slide or two before we adjourn here.
Mr. Chairman, I would like 5 minutes before we go to the floor.
Wonderful, absolutely. So let's continue for just another slide then.
Again, Laura Brooks for the record. On page 19, this is our sex offender management overview. We do have six institutions that provide sex offender treatment, and we have, I think it's about 120-bed capacity for sex offender treatment within our institutions. Again, with Palmer opening, that will add another house for sex offender treatment that we didn't have pre-COVID. We have about 300 community sex offender treatment slots. And then we also have rural telehealth treatment. This is new over the last 2 or 3 years. And the way we work that is in communities like Barrow, Kodiak, Kotzebue, Dillingham. We do sex offender treatment through video conferencing, and this allows the offenders to stay in their home communities, keep their jobs, keep whatever living situation they might have, instead of previously where they had to travel to a more urban community where sex offender treatment was available. So that's new, and that seems to have really helped alleviate that that need for individuals to come to those urban communities for treatment. And then overall, we have what's called the containment model, and that's the sex offender treatment model that we follow, where when individuals are released to probation or parole, they have specialized probation officers who are trained specifically in the needs of the sex offender population. That's then joined by a treatment team where they are, it's the treatment provider. It's a safety net that may include local clergy, other folks from their community. And then also they are provided with polygraphs on a regular basis. So that's the overall containment model that we use.
Okay, very good. I'd ask members to queue up any questions they have for Thursday's meeting. I know we are short on time here, so as we are out of time, I want to, again, thank you, Deputy Commissioner Good, and all your team for being here today. We look forward to seeing you again on Thursday. Our next meeting will be on Thursday, March 24th at 8 a.m., where the committee will have DOC back before us to finish up the presentation and take additional questions that committee members might have. With nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 9:54 a.m.